everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Celtics Talk Podcast. Kyle Draper joined, as always, by the man, the myth, the legend, Sherrod Blakely. See, you hate on you, bro.
Well, you do.
But that was a very good intro,
that,
right?
That was a weak hype man intro. I loved, I'll applaud the effort. I'm like that little kid in Cleveland. Good try. Good effort. Good try.
Dude, man. Usually I just skip over you, gloss over you. I'm like,
you
try
to.
You know, I try to, time I'm giving you some love. My man, fresh back from Milwaukee. Oh. We're going to talk about that big win for the Celtics over Giannis Antetokounmpo and the Milwaukee Bucks. You can always follow us on Twitter. You change your Twitter handle.
It's just Sherrod Blakely.
Sherrod, you keeping it simple.
Keep
just
it simple.
Sherrod Blakely. I'm Kyle Draper TV. We got a lot to get to in the next 25, 30 minutes or so. We're going to chat with Celtics assistant coach Walter McCarty. Sherrod, I know you had a chance to talk to him, about the Celtics, but about Rick Pitino also. You guys get into, you know, the latest scandal involving Rick Pitino and a whole lot more. That's all coming up in just a little bit. But first, let's get into these Celtics, my man. Wins over Philly.
Nice.
New York.
Nice.
Yeah, nice. But the big one over Milwaukee. To me, that was a statement game.
It was a signature win for a team that needed one, I think, just to kind of really put a little more distance between the Gordon Hayward out for the season, mantra, or I should say that cloud that has kind of hovered over this team really since the 5-minute mark of the first game. Milwaukee was the best team they've played this season without question. And, you know, the timing of the win I thought was important because, you know, the Greek Freak is having a ridiculously off the charts type season. I mean, first four games had 30 or more points. And Al Horford, I mean, we've seen Al play really good defense, but that was the best defense I've seen him play as a Celtic. His ability to not only hold his own with Giannis Antetokounmpo, but to frankly outplay him, which is something that I don't think very many guys can say they've done this year or even last year. It was a signature win for the Celtics, and really I thought a threshold type moment for Al Horford to really reassert himself as a significant player. And as you know, he's got his haters out there.
He's got his haters out there. Lumen Loney and I have gotten into it all week long about his average Al nickname, and I tell you what, this season Al's been anything but average. Forget about the numbers, Sherrod. You talked about the defense. Not only did he play great D on Antetokounmpo, but the game before against the unicorn, yeah. Kristaps Porzingis. Al is bringing it this season.
Right, and I mean, it's to the point now where, you know, it's still early in the season, obviously, but when you're thinking all NBA defensive players, Al has to be. If you're thinking about that this early, you have to have him in that conversation, not only because of the numbers, but because of the impact that he has made guarding guys with a variety of skill sets. This isn't like Kawhi Leonard, who guards the best wing guys night in, night out. Al has guarded the best hybrid wing/big guys, which to me is a much broader range of defensive challenges that you face when you've got guys like Porzingis, who's 7'3". He can shoot threes, and he was a non-factor. You got Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's maybe a shade below 7 feet, can handle the ball as good as anyone in the game, and yet he was a non-factor for the most part.
But go back to the previous game, Joel Embiid in Philly.
Right.
Embiid struggled against Al Horford and the Celtics, too.
And then in that same game, you've got to go from banging with him to trying to stand the perimeter with Ben Simmons, who's your size with a better handle. And he was a non-factor as well. So Al, he has had an impressive run defensively of limiting some really, really talented players. And the Celtics are winning games. And so you can't ask for more if you're a Celtics fan.
Yeah, we had our guy Sekou Smith on the show last week. And he mentioned, you know, people, even in Atlanta, you know, sometimes hated Al's game. I think hopefully we're at a point now where with Al Horford, we're not looking just at the box score.
Nope.
But I'll admit, Sherrod, I'm one of the biggest, people responsible for that, because when I see 7-2, I'm like, come on, Al, you got to do better. But, 8-5, to me, that's still not going to get it done. But if you're 13 points, 7 rebounds, and the team wins, you don't need to be doing a whole lot, more.
Al, I just think Al is one of those guys that you've got to take the good with the bad. I mean, and to me, the bad is those nights when I think he's a little too I want to get everyone involved, and I'm not going to look for my shots. And that's the worst. To me, that's when Al is at his worst. But when you think about all the problems that you can have with players, and this guy, the worst you're going to get out of him is because he wants to get his teammates too involved. You should live with that. That should not be a problem, because Al Horford has proven himself to be all about winning. You look at what he's done in Boston. From the time he got here to where he's at now, they have gotten better. And they were pretty good before that. You look at his time in Atlanta. They sucked. Horrible. Absolute. I mean, they were absolute trash.
Hold up. One of my guys was on Atlanta, so don't talk too bad about
Childress.
Them. Yeah, that's my guy.
Was part
so don't
of
hate
the
him.
Team in Atlanta that sucked. Okay? He put up decent numbers, but that team was really bad. Al gets there, and they don't just, you know, win a few more games. They go to the playoffs every single year he was there.
All he does is put your team in a position to win, man. And he helps you win games.
And I don't understand why people are constantly hating on him because he doesn't put up big numbers. He's never been a numbers guy. The Celtics made that clear. The Hawks made that clear. Everyone knows Al is about helping you win games. The numbers are never going to tell you the full story of his impact.
Yeah, and 27-9 against Milwaukee, and you know, he had the numbers and the impact too. It was an all-around great game for Al Horford. Kyrie Irving, he finally had – it wasn't even a full Kyrie, like, but he gave you enough of a Kyrie game, 24 points, to show you.
Listen, man.
He got them off to a good start, and he was the man.
That was it. Kyrie gave you just a glimpse at the cheat code.
Yeah, just a glimpse.
Because listen, because when you watch some of the things he does out there, it really does look like a video game where you're playing with the cheat code. He's doing moves that it just shouldn't be done. There was a possession where Malcolm Brogdon defended him as well as I've seen anyone defend him. I'm thinking, okay, Kyrie's going to have to take this forced, contested shot. And in a blink of an eye, it's like somebody found the cheat code, hit the B button. And next thing you know, Kyrie is in the middle of the lane for a short floater. He is that type of player. And I think the thing that we have to remember is it's going to take him a little while to figure out how he can be Kyrie and be all that Brad Stevens needs him to be.
Right.
You know, we talk about his offense a lot, and we never talk about his defense because he really doesn't give us a whole lot to talk about defensively. But he is not nearly as horrible a defender as I thought he was. He gambles more he gambles more than I like him to.
Is that like a backhanded compliment right there? No. He's not as bad as I thought he would be, actually.
I thought it was gonna be a big issue with him defensively. But the thing that he does a good job with is he's a little bit – well, not a little. He's a lot longer than Isaiah Thomas, and that length defensively has been an asset. I mean, he gets switched out having a guard, you know, Chris Middleton, who's about 6'7", 6'8". Chris goes up for a shot. Oh, no. Oh, no. Kyrie eats that up. That is not going to happen if you got Isaiah Thomas, who I still love to death. But Kyrie – and plus, Kyrie leads the team in deflection, so he's clearly getting his hands on a lot of balls as a defender. And to me, if that's your weakest link defensively, and he's playing – I think – not great, but adequate, you're going to be okay.
So how is this team doing so well defensively? Because I thought that would be a major issue this year, especially you lost Marcus Smart for a couple of games. No Avery Bradley, no Jay Crowder. But yet, here they are, you know, numbers-wise, they're, you know, one of the top 10 defensive teams in the league.
Yeah. I wrote about that for NBC Sports Boston. Shameless plug right there.
I know. I like that, though.
But, I mean, there are a lot of different factors. But some that jump out are the fact that they have guys who are longer. And so that when you are defending and there are pick-and-roll switches and things of that nature, you're not finding yourself at a disadvantage. I mean, if, for example, if you screen, you know, Jason Tatum and then you got a switch, you're probably dealing with, you know, Jaylen Brown or Al Horford. And that's not an advantage for you as an offensive player. And so, and it's scary how much better they would be if Gordon Hayward were healthy, because he is a very underrated defender in his time in Utah. So the Celtics, they have guys with great length. They have guys with attitude. I think the physicality element with Baines, that's a game changer. Marcus Smart is still doing what Marcus Smart does. And guys are just, they understand their roles. I think the injury to Gordon has forced them to really kind of galvanize and rely on one another more so than I think they probably would have with Gordon available. And so that, to me, there's a greater ownership when I can't let my man score because we're not whole. We have to be better on the defensive end because we don't have the weapons, as many weapons as we thought we were going to have offensively.
Yeah, you know, but they're doing it both ends of the floor. You know, you mentioned Aaron Baines. I love watching him play.
Dude.
I know Giannis almost ended his career.
when Baines went down, though, and he stayed down there for a little longer than we thought, and then he starts getting up, and then you see the smile. You're like, he's good.
He's good. But not a lot of people would challenge that attempt that
Giannis
had.
A lot of guys would have went to the bunker and said, okay, you got that deuce. You got those 2 points. He's not that dude. He's cut from a different cloth than most NBA players. I love the toughness. I love the physicality that he brings to the game. And if you're the Celtics, you need that. I mean, when you talk about winning championships and competing for titles, you got to have at least one legit tough guy. Not a guy who makes tough plays. A legitimate tough guy that if you are in an alley and it gets a little out of hand, you got to have one guy. You got to have one guy who can hold his own. At least one. They got a few.
All right, because you say tough. You know, when you talk to him, it does. You know, he doesn't come off as tough.
I'm telling you, he's got that. He's the kind of guy that scares the crap out of me. Because when you talk to him, he seems so nice, lovely conversation, always smiling. And then you watch him play, and he's smacking Greg Monroe around. He's banging Joel Embiid. He's taking charge, trying to take charges on guys who are like a good 40 feet in the air. I mean, he is a legitimate tough guy. And if you're the Celtics, and no disrespect to Amir, who I love to death,
right,
this is an upgrade. He is a legitimate upgrade in every sense of the word over what they had in Amir.
No, no doubt about that. So far, so good. Celtics rocking and rolling. You know, are you surprised that they've come together this quickly after the Gordon Hayward injury? And they're not a finished product. We know that, right. Sharad. But the way they're playing, I mean, this is Celtics basketball we're seeing from this squad, you know, a team basketball. I'm a little surprised that they've been able to turn that page and dial in the way they have over the last 3 years.
I'm surprised they've been able to do it and not have it being done in the fashion of Kyrie and Al carrying them all the way through that. We've seen Jaylen Brown. We've seen Tatum. We've seen Baines. We've seen Terry Rozier have great moments. Marcus Smart has had big moments. We've seen so many of their young guys who, to be candid, they shouldn't be ready for this moment.
Right.
This is not this game is not built for young people to come in and be that impactful in terms of winning. And yet, you go up and down this roster. I mean, they've got young fellas who are coming in and handling their business. Shimi Ojeleye, he literally has no idea whether he's going to play from one game to the next. He finds himself on the floor in the fourth quarter having to guard Giannis Antetokounmpo. And he doesn't just guard him. He puts the clamps on him.
He did.
Which is crazy because when watching that game firsthand, it was clear that Giannis knew, I don't really know this guy, so I'm going to go at him.
He tried to go at him, right?
He's fresh meat. This is fresh meat. And little did he know, fresh meat is like fresh 245-pound, I'm not moving an inch meat. And so Giannis, he had trouble. I mean, Giannis took 4 shots with Shimi on him, made one. And I think he had 1 or 2 turnovers in there as well. So having guys that you can just literally plug and play, just like that on the fly, who have no idea whether they're going to see minutes, it's a luxury that I think the Celtics are really getting major, major bang for.
Yeah,
right,
and give Brad Stevens a lot of credit. And, you know, we talk defense in an area where they're better than what we thought. Rebounding also, holding Milwaukee to 2 offensive rebounds, winning the rebounding battle. You mentioned, you know, in some of your writings and tweets, the defensive rebound percentage. Mm-hmm. Where is this coming from?
Well, it's coming from the way they're assembled. I mean, right now, because they have a positionless type style that they want to play, you've got guys who can rebound at every position. I mean, think about it. Terry Rozier often is the smallest dude on the floor. And if a ball goes up in the air and I got to put my money on one guy getting that rebound, I'm probably going to go with Rozier. And you go down the line, Jason Tatum, I think, has been a better rebounder than a lot of people thought. Jaylen Brown, I thought, had the potential to be a good rebounder, and he's been solid. And guys that we didn't know anything about, like Daniel Tice, he comes in all nothing but energy. He keeps a lot of balls alive, gets a lot of rebounds. You go down the line on this roster, and they have a team full of guys that understand the importance of defense and rebounding. And because they're doing a really good job in those two areas, they're going to have a chance to win every night they step on the floor. Because if you're able to hold your own on the boards and you're playing good defense, there's not going to be many nights where you're going to be out of the game. And if you're the Celtics and you got a coach like Brad Stevens, that's what you want. Position yourself to have a chance to win and see if he can put the right combinations together and get it done down the stretch.
Yeah, the Celtics looking good so far. You mentioned Brad Stevens. props to his staff also. They're doing a great job working with the guys. I know you had a chance to catch up with Walter McCarty, a member of the Celtics staff. You guys, tell me what you guys talked about. Tell the people what you talked about.
We talked about a lot of different things. We talked about, you know, coming up is going to be the anniversary of Rick Pitino's first game coaching the Celtics, and Walter was in that starting lineup. And surprisingly, he remembers that game very well. And he has his reasons for that, but I think the main reason he remembers that game is because they won. They didn't win a lot of games under Pitino. So, exactly. So to get it off to get things popping from the jump, that was good. And Walter, you know, I don't know if people all know this, but I mean, he played for Pitino in college. He was an assistant coach with him at the college level, and played for him with the Celtics as well. So they have a long-standing relationship, and he has had communication with him since things went sideways with Louisville. And Walter, I'll let him get into that and how that whole situation, his take on how things have kind of transpired with Coach.
All right, let's dive into Sherrod's interview with Walter McCarty right now on the Celtics Talk podcast.
Here with Walter McCarty, Celtics assistant coach. And Walter, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the first game that Rick Pitino coached here with the Boston Celtics. You were in the starting lineup that night. Do you remember much about that game against the Bulls?
I do. I remember we won that game. Mm-hmm. It was a fun atmosphere. And we were very lucky. We were young. We were really excited for the game. I'm pretty sure they were probably still worn out from winning the championship. But it was fun. Our fans were really excited and just playing the Bulls. You know, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and Kukoc and Rapp and all those guys. It was a fun game. It was a fun game. That was his first game?
Yeah, that was his first game. Wow. It was on Halloween.
That was tough. So I remember. So I got traded really close to the first. So I got traded the last preseason game. I was in Boston. With the Knicks, we were playing them. I got traded before I came to the arena. So all that stuff, it just happened really fast. Never got to go back home to my place. And then I'm starting the game for a new team, running a new offense. So it was crazy. But I remember it being a fun atmosphere.
What is that like as a player when you got to kind of have to just pick up everything on the fly and just not only rearrange your life, but play the game?
It's tough, man. You got a whole new different calls and just trying to figure out, all right, what does this mean? And you just got a lot of things going on, a million things going on at one time. But you just have to do your best you can. Good thing for me, I was familiar with a lot of stuff that he was doing from college, so that helped me out a lot. If not for that, it would have been probably a little tougher. But it was fun. I just remember us having a lot of fun, being young, and just really just playing hard and just enjoying the game.
Was there a lot of difference that you could tell from when you played for him as a college kid versus as a pro? Was his demeanor or just his tact any different?
I think he was even more driven because it was a big challenge for him. I think at Kentucky, obviously we had talent. He was driven. We play hard. He practices hard. All that stuff. But we knew we were going to win games with our talent. I think him coming here and having the team and I think he put a lot of pressure on himself. I don't think there was a lot of pressure to win, but I think he put a lot of pressure on himself to win and be competitive and try to turn this thing around. And I think that was I think that probably ended up being what led to probably like a lot of the failures here, but just trying to do it too fast, not letting the process happen.
Right. And as someone who played for him at both the college and pro level, and as an assistant coach on his staff, what are some of the lessons that you learned from him that you kind of take with you as you go forward in your coaching career?
A lot of lessons. A lot of it, though, like on the practice floor, you know, preparation, prepping for teams and being ready. Just doing all the small details, make sure all the small details add up, and I'm just being ready to play and how hard you have to play, you know, to win games, all the things that you have to do to win games. So I think that's probably some of the biggest things that I've taken along with me.
And have you had a chance to talk to him just since his departure from Louisville?
Yeah, we talk, we text all the time.
Well, how's he doing? How are his spirits? I mean, I know that's a rough, you know, situation.
I think he's good right now. I think he's pretty confident in what he's done there, what he's been able to do in his legacy. I know Coach B for a long time now, and I've never known him to to do any of those things that's been said. So I feel very confident in them, and I think he'll be vindicated.
When things obviously didn't work out here in Boston, a big part of that, certainly a lot of the talk centered around not getting that number one pick, which would have been Tim Duncan. How different do you think things would have gone for him if he would have been able to get that type of player for this franchise, knowing all the other things that he had going on?
I don't know, man. It's hard to play that game. Who knows? I mean, look at the guys who end up having good careers. Chauncey Billups,
right,
and Joe Johnson. And those guys, what if they had stayed? What if, you know what I mean? You can play so many different games with that. And those guys went on to have nice careers. Nobody thought they would have the careers that they had. So, just never know. You know, Tim could have came here and just don't know.
Right.
You know, you have Tim playing alongside Antoine Walker, two guys who play in the box, and who knows how would he have been able to develop? No, Tim was very fortunate. We all talk about Tim Duncan, but as much as Tim Duncan helped David Robinson, you better believe David Robinson helped Tim Duncan a lot. You know what I mean? So he was able to learn from a Hall of Famer, a guy who had game and, you know, been around him every day. So, you know, maybe he didn't learn as fast. You know, if David Robinson's not around. You know, maybe he's not the Tim Duncan he becomes. But maybe he is. We don't know that. But there's a lot of different scenarios that come into play. You just don't know, you know.
And lastly, if there's – knowing Coach Pitino the way you do, if there's one thing you wish people knew about him that they probably don't know, what would be that one thing?
How much he cares about his players and family. And, he tries to do the right thing by his team. And and he's very fair, his players. And so to say you're shocked, surprised to hear something like that, I'm totally shocked because I just don't see that being the case. And I think that would be it, how much he really cares about the game and about his players.
How tough is that as someone who knows him that well to see the things that have been said and written about him, mm-hmm, and knowing that the coach that you know is very different from that image that a lot of people have of him?
Well, I mean, excuse me, it's tough that he has to deal with that, but it's so funny that, you know, I've been in these recruiting meetings and these recruiting homes and on campus, and all these writers and all these analysts or sports, they say all these things, and they've never been on these recruiting meetings, or they have no clue. They say these things, they have no clue how it works, and it's very possible for him, it's very easy for him not to know. There's so many things that can go on behind closed doors that it's so easy for him not to know. Like, people say, well, he should have known, he should have done this. It doesn't work like that. So I've been there. I've been on the road. I've been recruiting in the dorms. Trust me, there's a lot of things that go on a college campus or wherever that the head coaches don't know about. And it's unfortunate, but that's just the truth. You know, can you imagine all the things that you've done in college that most of your friends don't know about? You know, think about that. So, I mean, it's just so funny that people, they're so hard, they're so quick to judge, but they have no clue about this game and about recruiting and all these stuff. They have no clue, you know, because they don't know how this stuff works. So,
Walter McCarty, Boston Celtics assistant coach, thank you so much for your time, Mr. McCarty.
You got it, brother.
Appreciate you.
All right, man.
One of my favorite guys, Walter McCarty. Shout out to him for sitting down with you, Shariah, talking to you. It's funny because Walt and I, we were in Louisville at the same time. He was on Pitino's staff in Louisville, and it's crazy to see just that program crumble the way it has. Rick Pitino was a god out there in Louisville, and now not a part of the program. He's gone, you know?
Yeah, it's tough to see. And you never like to see, even if you are a fan of, you know, an arch rival, you don't like to see, you know, coaches go down like that. I mean,
Hold on. You know we're in Boston, right? Celtics fans, I'm wondering if they like, see, Rick, that's what you get. You deserve that.
Well, I think
that.
There's a lot of that, but there's no question about that. But I don't like to see any of that happen because you just don't like to see people's lives devastated like that. And obviously, you know, the flip side of that is what about the kids and the folks who've been affected by some of the things that happened in his program? But like Walter had mentioned, and you know, there's there's so many things that happen in college athletics that literally the head coach can be totally out of the loop on. Because you got the thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is that when you're the head coach, you are where your assistants want to be someday.
Right.
And
right.
sometimes that desire on their part to get there, sometimes they kind of, you know, sometimes they just bend the rules a little bit. And they don't necessarily make
Because they're ambitious. They're trying to, you
sometimes
know.
Sometimes the ambition gets the best of them, and I get that. And I do believe there's some of that. But obviously, you know, no one is going to know the full truth of how things, you know, played out with Louis. But certainly, you know, that program, it's a black eye for them without question.
Yeah, when you look at college coaches making a jump to the NBA, didn't work for Patino, Calipari, PJ, but yet, it's working for Brad. Do you think that whole narrative, college coach can't succeed in the NBA, is over and done with? And do you think, what's it take, I guess, for a college coach to be successful like Brad has been so far?
Well, I think part of it has to do with, you know, college coaches now, the teaching that they were told they would be doing at the college level, they have to be doing at the NBA level because guys are coming to the league not ready to play right away. So there is more teaching along the NBA level now, which I think gives college coaches a better chance to succeed. I mean, you look at guys like Evan Turner, who had been in the NBA for a few years, but he clearly grew when he played, you know, under Brad Stevens. You look at guys like Avery Bradley, who got better. Isaiah Thomas, his game, you know, expanded under Brad. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Brad, I think, at his essence, is a teacher. And so that, I think, is different than 10, 15, 20 years ago when coaches from the college ranks came in. They weren't trying to teach. They were trying to be taskmasters. And that didn't always work out because you're telling grown men that I should trust you, and you've only been dealing with 18, 19, and 20 years.
Right.
I'm 26 years old. I make more money than you, coach. How are you going to tell me what I'm supposed to do?
Right.
Now you've got kids coming to the league who are a lot of the same kids that these college coaches who come to the NBA were recruiting just a year or two ago.
Yeah, and I also think, too, back then, along those same lines, like, if you're a college coach, you can't, you know, in college, you're a king of the castle.
Right.
You are the top dog on a college campus, usually, the college football and college basketball coach. You come to the NBA, like you said, these dudes making more money than you. They're more established than you. And so if you come into the NBA with that ego, even more so back then, it's not going to work. And I think that's one of the reasons why Brad has succeeded, you know, I'm sure he has some ego, but he doesn't let it on. You know what I mean?
He's very self-deprecating. Yeah. He's very humble. He's a lot of the things that, you know, players of today like in their head coach, because obviously the coach, he's not putting himself in his status ahead of me. I'm going to get my shine on, says the player.
Yep.
My coach, he's cool being in the backdrop. Not all coaches are like that. And Rick Pitino specifically is not that type of coach. Front and center, spotlight. Find
it is
me.
It's all on me. All right, A. Sherrod Blakely, another great episode of the Celtics Talk podcast. Shout out to Walter McCarty for coming on, joining Sherrod. Plenty of great stuff from him. Make sure you follow us on Twitter, A. Sherrod Blakely, Kyle Draper TV, also at NBCS Celtics. And make sure you subscribe to the Celtics Talk podcast on all your favorite podcasting apps. And leave a message and give us a shout out, all right? We need some followers, Sherrod. I want it to be the number one basketball podcast in Boston. We could do that, big fella.
We can do that. As soon as you get rid of that outfit you got on tonight. The folks at home, they can't see this, but he is decked out in his Al Horford, socks up to his kneecaps. Looking like a little black leprechaun up in here.
Hey, I look know, remember Walt Williams from Maryland?
Yeah, I remember Walt Williams.
He had the socks like
this.
I was
thinking more like Elliot Perry.
Oh, Elliot Perry. All right, man, let's get out of here. That'll do it for this week of the Celtics Talk podcast.
We out! Thank God.